Chapter 3. Karaskand. If soot stains your tunic, dye it black. This is vengeance. Ecyanus I, 44 Epistles. Here we find further argument for Gataga's supposition that the world is round. How else could all men stand higher than their brothers? Agensis, Discourse on War. Early Spring, 4112, Year of the Tusk, Karaskand. The Dry Season. On the steppe, it betrayed its coming with a variety of signs. The first sight of the lance among the stars on the northern horizon, the quickness with which the milk soured, the first trailers of the kaunu, the midsummer wind. At the beginning of the rainy season, Skilvendi herdsmen ranged the steppe in search of the sandy ground where the grasses grew quicker. When the rains waxed, they drove their herds to harder ground, where the grasses grew slower but remained green longer. Then, when the hot winds chased the clouds to oblivion, they simply followed the forage, always searching for the wild herbs and short grasses that made for the best meat and milk. This pursuit always caught someone, particularly those who were too greedy to cull willful animals from their herd. Headstrong cattle could lead an entire herd too far afield, into vast tracts of overgrazed or blighted pasture. Every season, it seemed, some fool returned without horse or cattle. Neyur now knew himself to be that fool.
I have given him the holy war.
In the council chamber of the dead Sapatisha, Neyur sat high on the tiers that surrounded the council table, watching the Dunyain intently. He did his best to ignore the Enrithi crowding the seats about him, but he found himself continually accosted, congratulated. One fool, some Tidoni Thane, even had the temerity to kiss his knee. His knee! Once again they called out, Skilvendi, as though in salute. Flanked by hanging gold on black representations of the circumfix, the warrior prophet sat upon a raised dais so that he looked down upon the great names sitting about the council table. His beard had been oiled and braided, his flaxen hair tumbled across his shoulders. Beneath a stiff, knee-length vestment, he wore a white silk gown embroidered by the forking of silvery leaves and gray branches. Braziers had been set about him, and in their light he seemed aqueous, surreal, every bit the otherworldly prophet he claimed to be. His luminous eyes roamed the room, stirring gasps and whispers wherever they passed. Twice his look found Neyur, who cursed himself for looking away.
Wretched, wretched!
The sorcerer, the woman-hearted buffoon whom everyone had thought dead, stood before the dais to the Dunyain's left, wearing an ankle-length vest of crimson over a white linen frock. He, at least, wasn't festooned like a slaver's concubine, as were the others. But he had a look in his eyes that Neyur recognized, as though he too couldn't quite believe the lot fortune had cast him. Neyur had overheard Uranyanka on the tier below saying that the man, Drusus Akamian, was now the warrior prophet's vizier, his teacher and protector. Whatever he was, he looked obscenely fat compared with the rakish Enrithi caste nobles. Perhaps, Neyur thought, the Dunyain planned to use his bulk as a shield should the consult or Kishorim attack. The great names sat about the table as before, though now stripped of the hauteur belonging to their station. Where once they had been bickering kings, the lords of the Holy War, they were now little more than counselors, and they knew it. They were silent for the most part, pensive. Occasionally one of them would lean to mutter something in his neighbor's ear, but nothing more. In the course of a single day, the world these men had known had been struck to its foundation, utterly overturned. There was wonder in that. Neyur knew this only too well. But there was an absurd uncertainty also. For the first time in their lives, they stood upon trackless ground, and with few exceptions, they looked to the Dunyain to show them the way, much as Neyur had once looked to Muengus. As the last of the lesser names hunted seats across the tiers, the rumble of hushed voices trailed into expectant silence. The air beneath the corbelled dome seemed to whine with a collective discomfort. For these men, Nayor realized, the warrior prophet's presence collapsed too many intangible things. How could they speak without praying, disagree without blaspheming? Even the presumption to advise would seem an act of outrageous conceit. In the safety of unanswered prayers, they had thought themselves pious. Now they were like boasting gossips, astounded to find their story's principle in their midst. And he might say anything, throw their most cherished conceits upon the pyre of his condemnation. What would they do, the devout and self-righteous alike? What would they do now that their hallowed scripture could talk back? Nayor almost barked with laughter. He lowered his head and spat between his knees. He cared not if others marked his sneer. There was no honor here, only advantage, absolute and irremediable. There was no honor, but there was truth, was there not? The insufferable ritual and pageantry which seemed obligatory to all things in Rethi began with Gotian reciting the temple prayer. He stood as rigid as an adolescent in vestments that appeared newly made, white cloth with intricate panels, each embroidered with two golden tusks crossing a golden circle, yet another version of the circumfix. His voice shook as he spoke, and he halted once, overcome with passion. Nayor found himself looking about the chamber, his breath tight in his chest, quietly astounded that men wept rather than jeered. And then, for the first time, the depths of the dread purpose that moved these men became palpable. He had seen it. He had witnessed it on the fields beyond Karaskan's wall, the lunatic determination, enough to shame even his Utamot. He had watched men vomit boiled grass as they stumbled forward. He had seen others who could scarce walk throw themselves upon the weapons of the heathen just to disarm them. He had seen men smile, cry out in joy, as the mastodons descended upon them. He could remember thinking that these men, these in Rethi, were the true people of war. Nayor had seen it, but he had not understood, not fully. What the Dunyane had wrought here would never be undone. Even if the holy war should perish, the word of these events would survive. Ink would make this madness immortal. Kellis had given these men more than gestures or promises, more even than insight or direction. He had given them dominion over their doubts, over their most hated foes. He had made them strong. But how could lies do such a thing? The world these men dwelt within was a fever dream, a delusion. And yet it seemed as real to them, Nayor knew, as his world seemed to him. The only difference, and Nayor was curiously troubled by the thought, was that he could, in meticulous detail, track the origins of their world within his, and only then because he knew the Dunyane. Of all those congregated in this room, he alone knew the ground, the treacherous footing beneath their feet. Suddenly, everything Nayor witnessed was parsed in two, as though his eyes had become enemies, one against the other. Gotian had completed the temple prayer, and several of the Dunyane's high priests, his nascenti, had begun a whelming for those among the lesser names who'd been too ill to partake in the ceremony previously. A flaming basin of oil had been set before the warrior prophet, who sat idle still. The first of the initiates, a Thunieri by the look of his braids, knelt beside the tripod, then exchanged inaudible orisons with the administering priest. Though his face had been battered by pestilence and war, his eyes were those of a 10-year-old, pinned wide in hope and apprehension. In a single motion, the priest dipped his hand into the burning oil, then drew it across the Thunieri's features. For a heartbeat, the man gazed from a face aflame, until a second priest doused him with a wet towel. The room thundered with exultant cries, and the thane, his expression bent by profound passion, staggered into the jubilant arms of his comrades. For the Inrithi, the man had crossed an intangible threshold. They had watched a profound transformation, a base soul raised to the assembly of the elect. Where before he'd been polluted, now he was cleansed, and they had witnessed this with their own eyes. Who could question it? But for Nayor, The only threshold crossed was that between foolishness and outright idiocy. He had watched an instrument, not a sacred rite, a mechanism, like the elaborate mills he had seen in Nansour, a way for the Dunyane to grind these men into something he could digest. And this, too, was something he had seen with his own eyes. Unlike the Enrithi, he did not stand within the circle of the Dunyane's deceit. Where they saw things from within, he saw them from without. He saw more. It was strange the way beliefs could have an inside and an outside, that what looked like hope or truth or love from within could be a scythe or a hammer, things wielded for other ends when seen from without. Tools. Nayur breathed deeply. This thought had tormented him once. It had been one too many. He leaned forward, elbows on knees, absently watching the farce unfold. The Enrithi, Proyas had told him once, believed it was the lot of man to live within the designs, inscrutable or otherwise, of those greater than themselves. And in this sense, Nayur realized, Kellis truly was their prophet. They were, as the memorialists claimed, willing slaves, always striving to beat down the furies that drove them to sovereign ends. That the designs, the tracks they claimed to follow, were authored in the outside, simply served their vanity, allowed them to abase themselves in a manner that fanned their overweening pride. There was no greater tyranny, the memorialist said, than that exercised by slaves over slaves. But now, the slavers stood among them. What did it matter, Kellis had asked as they crossed the step, that he mastered those already enslaved? There was no honor, only advantage. To believe in honor was to stand inside things, to keep company with slaves and fools. The whelming had come to a close, and Saban, the titular king of Karaskand, was standing, called to account by the warrior prophet.
I will not march, the Galeoth prince said in a dead voice. Karaskand is mine. I will not relinquish it, even if I be damned as a result.
But the warrior prophet has demanded that you march,
silver-haired Gotian cried. Something about the way the man said warrior prophet made Nayur's hackles rise, something febrile and unmanly. The Grand Master of the Shrial Knights, who had been the Dunyane's most implacable foe before the exposure of Sarcellus, had since become his most fervent devotee. Such fickleness of spirit only deepened Nayur's contempt for these people.
I will not march,
Saban repeated, as though speaking from a nightmare. The Galeoth prince, Nayur noted, actually had the temerity to wear his iron crown to this particular council. Even though tall, ruddy with sun and warlike health, the man looked an adolescent playing king beneath the warrior prophet.
By my hand I have seized this city, and by my hand I shall keep it.
Sweet Sejanus,
Gothiel cried.
By your hand, and a thousand others maybe.
I opened the gates,
Saban retorted fiercely.
I delivered the city to the holy war.
You delivered precious little that you haven't kept,
Lord Kinjosa quipped. He looked pointedly at the iron crown as he spoke, smirking as though recalling a joke traded in secret.
Headaches,
Gothyalk added, clenching a gray-haired fist.
He's delivered many a headache.
I simply demand what's mine by right, Saban snarled. Proyas, you agreed to support me, Proyas.
The Cunryan prince glanced uneasily at the Dunyane, then stared evenly at the would-be Karaskandi king. During the siege, he had refused to eat more than his men, so he was gaunt, and he looked older now that he was growing his beard out square like his father's kinsman.
No, I'll not renege on my pledge, Saban.
Indecision slackened his handsome face.
But things have changed.
The debate was a sham, the preserving of certain motions to advance a sense of continuity. Proyas had fairly shouted this, though he would never admit to it. Only one decision mattered. All eyes had climbed to the warrior prophet. Fierce before his peers, Saban now seemed petulant, a king unmanned beneath the vaults of his own palace. Those who carry the war to Holy Shima
the warrior prophet said, his voice falling upon them like a knife prick. Must do so freely.
No, Sauban said hoarsely. Please, no.
At first, this answer escaped Nayur. Then he realized the Dunyain had forced Sauban to choose his own damnation. He returned their choices to them only when he needed them to be accountable. Such maddening subtlety. The warrior prophet shook his leonine head.
There is nothing to be done.
Strip him of his throne, Ikuri Confis said abruptly. Have him dragged into the streets.
He shrugged in the manner of long-suffering men.
Have his teeth beaten from his head.
Astonished silence greeted his words. As the first among the Orthodox conspirators, and as Sarcellus's confidant, no less, Confis had become an outcast among the great names. In the council preceding the battle, he'd contributed little, and when he did talk, it was with the awkwardness of one forced to speak an unfamiliar tongue. It seemed that his patience had at last been exhausted. The exalt general looked to his astounded peers, snorted. He wore his blue mantle in the Nansur fashion, thrown up and across the stamped gold of his breastplate. Among all those assembled, he alone seemed unmarked, unscarred, as though mere days had passed since that fateful council on the Endiamine Heights. He turned to the warrior prophet.
Such things lie within the scope of your power, do they not? Insolence! Gothyelk hissed. You don't know what you're saying!
I assure you, old fool, I always know what I'm saying.
And what? The warrior prophet said. What might that be? Confis managed a defiant smile.
That this, all of this, is a sham. That you,
he glanced again at the surrounding faces,
are a fraud.
Whispers of hushed outrage rifled through the chamber. The Dunyain merely smiled. But this is not what you say. It seemed that Confis sensed, for perhaps the first time, the impossible dimensions of the Dunyain's authority over the men surrounding him. The warrior prophet was more than their center, as a general might be. He was their center and their ground. These men had to trim not only their words and actions to conform to his authority, but their passions and hopes as well. The very movements of their souls now answered to the warrior prophet.
But, Confis said blankly, how could another?
Another? The warrior prophet asked. Don't confuse me with any other, Ikuri Confis. I am here with you. He leaned forward in a way that made Nayur catch his breath. I am here in you.
In me,
the exalt general repeated. He had tried to sound contemptuous, Nayur knew, but he sounded frightened instead. I realize, the Dunyain continued, that you speak these words out of impatience, that you've chafed at the changes my presence has wrought in the Holy War. I know that the strength I've delivered to the men of the Tusk threatens your designs. I know that you're unsure as to how to proceed, that you don't know whether to offer the same pretense of submission that you offer your uncle, or to discredit me with open words. So now you deny me out of desperation, not to prove to others that I'm a fraud, but to prove to yourself that you are, in fact, my better. For an obscene arrogance dwells within you, Ikuri Confis, the belief that you are the measure of all other men. It is this lie that you seek to preserve at all costs.
Not true,
Confis cried, bolting from his chair. No? Then tell me, Exalt General, how many times have you thought yourself a god? Confis licked tight lips.
Never!
The warrior prophet nodded skeptically. It is peculiar, isn't it, the place you find yourself standing? To preserve your pride before me, you must endure the shame of lying. You must conceal who you are in order to prove who you are. You must degrade yourself to remain proud. At this moment, you see this more clearly than at any other time in your life, and yet still you refuse to relinquish, to yield to your tormented pride. You trade the anguish that breeds anguish for the anguish that breeds release. You would rather take pride in what you are not than take pride in what you are.
Silence!
Confis screeched.
No one speaks to me this way! No one!
Shame is a stranger to you, Ikuri Confis. An unbearable stranger. Wild-eyed, Confis stared at the congregated faces. The sound of weeping filled the room, the weeping of other men who'd recognized themselves in the warrior prophet's words. Nayur watched and listened, his skin awash with dread, his heart pounding in his throat. Ordinarily, he would have taken deep satisfaction in the exalt general's humiliation, but this was of a different order. Shame itself now reared above them, a beast that devoured all certainties, that wrapped cold coils about the fiercest souls.
How does he do this?
Release, the warrior prophet said, as though a word could be the world's only unbarred door. All I offer you, Ikuri Confis, is release. The exalt general stumbled back a step, and for a mad moment it almost seemed that his knees would buckle, that the Emperor's nephew might kneel. But then a curious, almost blood-chilling laugh escaped his throat. A hidden madness flashed through the cracks of his mien.
Listen to him, Gotian hissed plaintively. Don't you see, man? He's the prophet!
Confis looked at the Grand Master without comprehension. His beauty seemed all the more astonishing for the blankness of his expression. You are among friends here, Proyas said. Brothers. Gotian and Proyas. Other men and other words. These apparently broke the spell of the Dunyane's voice for Confis as much as for Nayur.
Brother, he snarled. I'm no brother to slaves. You think he knows you? That he speaks the hearts of men? He does not. Trust me, my brothers. We, Ikuri, know a thing or two about words and men. He plays you, and you know it not. He tacks truth after truth to your heart to better yoke the blood beating underneath. Gulls, slaves, to think I once congratulated myself on your company.
He turned his back to the great names, began shouldering his way toward the crowded entrance.
Halt!
The Dunyane thundered. Everyone, including Nayur, flinched. Confis stumbled as though struck. Arms and hands clasped him, turned him, thrust him into the center of the warrior prophet's attention.
Kill him!
Someone to Nayur's right cried.
Apostate!
Pealed from the benches below. Then the tears fairly erupted in hoarse outrage. Fists pounded the shivering air. Confis looked about him, more stunned than terrified, like a boy struck by a beloved uncle.
Pride, the warrior prophet said, silencing the chamber like a carpenter sweeping sawdust from his workbench. Pride is a sickness. For most, it's a fever, a contagion goaded by the glories of others. But for some, like you, Ikuri Confis, it is a defect carried from the womb. For your whole life you've wondered what it was that moved the men about you. Why would a father sell himself into slavery when he need only strangle his children? Why would a young man take the orders of the Tusk, exchange the luxuries of his station for a cubicle, authority for servitude to the Holy Shrier? Why do so many give when it is so easy to take? But you ask these questions because you know nothing of strength. For what is strength but the resolve to deny base inclinations? The determination to sacrifice in the name of one's brothers? You, Ikuri Confis, know only weakness. And because it takes strength to acknowledge weakness, you call your weakness strength. You betray your brother. You fresco your heart with flatteries. You, who are less than any man, say to yourself, I am a god. The exalt general's reply was little more than a whisper, but it resounded across every crook and span of the chamber.
No.
Shame. Wutrum. Nayur had thought that his hatred of the Dunyane was without measure, that it could be eclipsed by nothing. But the shame that filled this room, the bowel-loosening humiliation, knocked his rancor from him. For an instant, he saw the warrior prophet, not the Dunyane, and he stood in awe of him. For an instant,
He found himself inside the man's lies. Your columns, Kellis continued, will disarm. You will then decamp for Joktha, where you will await passage back to the Nansorium. You are no longer a man of the Tusk, I curi confess. In truth, you never were. The exalt general blinked in astonishment, as though these words had offended his person and not those preceding. The man, Nayor realized, did suffer some defect of the soul, just as the Dunyain had said.
Why?
The exalt general asked, recovering the force of his old voice.
Why should I accede to these demands?
Kellis stood, approached the man. Because I know, he said, stepping from the dais. For some reason, leaving the illumination of the braziers did nothing to diminish his miraculous bearing. He wore all light to his advantage. I know the Emperor has struck treaties with the heathen. I know that you plan to betray the Holy War before Shaima is regained. Confis shrank before his aspect, retreated until caught in the arms of the faithful. Nayor recognized several among them, Gedeki, Tuthorsa, Semper, their eyes bright with something more than hatred. For some reason, they looked 1,000 years old, ancient with certitude. Because, Kellis continued, looming over him, if you fail to comply, I will have you flayed and hung from the gates. The tenor of his voice was such that the word flay and the skinless images it conjured seemed to linger. Confis stared up in abject horror. His lower lip quivered, and his face broke into a soundless sob, only to stiffen, then break again. Nayor found himself clutching his breast. Why did his heart race so? Release him, the warrior prophet murmured. And the exalt general fled through the entranceway, shielding his face, waving his hands as though pelted with stones. Again, Nayor stood outside the Dunyain's machinations. The accusations of treachery he knew were likely a contrivance, nothing more. What would the Emperor gain from abetting his ancestral enemies? Everything that had transpired, Nayor realized, had been premeditated. Everything. Every word, every look, every insight had some function. But for what end? To make an example of Ikuri Confis? To remove him? Why not simply cut his throat? No. Of all the great names, only Ikuri Confis, the far-famed Lion of Kaiuth, possessed the force of character to retain the loyalty of his men. Kellis would brook no competitors, but neither would he risk what remained of the Holy War in internecine conflict. That alone had preserved the exalt general's life. Kellis had withdrawn, and the men of the Tusk stood and stretched on the tiers, calling, laughing, wondering. And once more, Nayor found himself watching them with two sets of eyes. The Enrithi, he knew, would see themselves forged and reforged, their temper improved for the want of impurities. But he knew otherwise. The dry season had not ended. Perhaps it never would. The Dunyain simply culled the willful from his herd. Struggling to remain stationary in the crush of bodies, Proyas scanned the milling crowds once again, searching for the Skilvendi. Only moments earlier, the warrior prophet had withdrawn to thunderous acclaim. Now the lords of the Holy War rumbled amongst themselves, exchanging exclamations of hilarity and outrage. There was much to discuss. The Ikuri plot uncovered, the Nansur columns cast out of the Holy War, the exalt general humiliated, debased.
I wager the Imperial loincloth warrants changing,
Gedeki cried out from a nearby knot of Kenryan caste nobles. Laughter boomed through the packed antechamber. It was both merciless and full-hearted, though not, Proyas noted, without strains of apprehension. The triumphal looks, the shrill declarations, the avid gestures and protestations, all spoke to the youth of their conversion. But there was something else as well, something Proyas could feel haunting the corners of his own aching face. Fear. Perhaps this was to be expected. As Agensis was so fond of observing, habit ruled the souls of men. So long as the past governed the present, those habits could be depended on. But the past had been overturned, and now the men of the Tusk found themselves stranded with judgments and assumptions they could no longer trust. They had learned that the metaphor cut both ways. To be reborn, Proyas had come to realize, one must murder who one was. It seemed such a small price, ludicrously small, given what they had gained. With the Skilvendi nowhere in sight, Proyas sorted the faces into those who had condemned Kellis and those who had not. Many, like in Gaiaban, stood quiet between outbursts, their eyes wide with contrition, their lips pinched in chagrin. But others, like Athgieri, spoke with the easy bravado of the vindicated. Watching them, Proyas felt envy claw through him, forcing his eyes downward and away. Never, it seemed, had the need to undo so overwhelmed him, not even with a Commian. What had he been thinking? How could he, a man who had meticulously hammered his heart into the very shape of piety, have come so close to murdering the god's own voice? The thought still dizzied him, struck him nauseous with shame. Conviction, no matter how narcotic its depth, simply did not make true. This was a hard lesson, made all the harder by its astounding conspicuousness. Despite the exhortations of kings and generals, despite the endless lays, belief unto death was cheap. After all, the Fainim threw themselves against the spears of their enemies as readily as the Enrithi. Someone had to be deluded. So what ensured that that someone was someone else? Given the manifest frailty of men, given the long succession of delusions that was their history, what could be more preposterous than claiming oneself the least deluded, let alone privy to the absolute? And to make such obvious conceit the grounds of condemnation, of murder? In all his life, Proyas had never wept so hard as he had at the warrior prophet's feet, for he who had decried avarice in all its forms had proven the most avaricious of all. He had coveted nothing so much as the truth, and since truth had so roundly eluded him, he had turned to his beliefs. How could he not, when he'd spent a lifetime abasing himself before them, when they afforded him such luxury of judgment, when they were so much who he was? The promise of rebirth was at once the threat of murder, and Proyas, like so many others, had opted to kill rather than die. Hush, the warrior prophet had said. Mere hours had passed since Kellis had been cut down from Umiaki. Blood still soaked the bandages about his wrists, forming black rings.
You need not weep, Proyas.
But I tried to kill you. A beatific smile, jarring given the obvious pain it contradicted.
All our acts turn upon what we assume to be true, Proyas, what we assume to know. The connection is so strong, so thoughtless, that when those things we need to be true are threatened, we try to make them true with our acts. We condemn the innocent to make them guilty. We raise the wicked to make them holy. Like the mother who continues nursing her dead babe, we act out our refusal. Kellis had paused in the breathless way he so often did, as if communing with voices that others could almost hear. He raised his hand in a curious gesture, as though to ward away hard words. Proyas could still remember the blood smeared like ink into the whorls of his palm, dark against the gold that haloed his outstretched fingers. When we believe without ground or cause, Proyas, conviction is all we possess, and acts of conviction become our only demonstration. Our beliefs become our God, and we make sacrifices to appease them. And as simply as that, he had been absolved, as though to be known was to be forgiven. Without warning, the Skilvendi floated into view, towering above those crowded about the entrance to the audience chamber. Rather than a shirt, he sported a vest of coins netted in leather string to let his wounds breathe, Proyas imagined. He wore the same iron-plated girdle as he had from the first, cinched over a kilt of black damask. His scarred arms were things of statuary, and Proyas noticed several flinch from them, as though the slaughter they signified might be contagious. Without exception, the men of the Tusk shrank from his path, as dogs might before a lion or tiger. There was something about the Skilvendi, Proyas knew, that sent panic muttering through the bones of even the most granite-hearted. It was more than his barbarous heritage, more than the feral power that seemed to emanate from every cord of his frame, more even than the air of brooding intelligence that lent such profundity to his look. There was a sense of void about Naor Ur Skiotha, an absence of constraint that suggested any brutality could be possible. The most violent of men. That was what Kellis had called him, and he had told Proyas to take care. Madness has claimed him. For not the first time, Proyas considered the puckered wound about the barbarian's throat. Heeding his gaze, Naor soon hulked before him, his glacial eyes all the more striking for the black of his crazed mane. He nodded curtly when Proyas bid him follow. As Proyas turned, Zynemus caught his elbow, and the Cunhraian prince found himself leading both men through the red-glazed galleries of the Sapatashah's palace. No one said a word. Pausing in the long shadows of the processional courtyard, he turned to the Skilvendi, resisted the urge to step outside the circuit of his reach.
So, what did you think?
That Confess will laugh himself to sleep.
Naor snapped contemptuously.
But you did not summon me to sound my thoughts.
No.
Proyas?
Zynemus asked, as though only now realizing the impropriety of his presence.
I should leave you two.
He came because there was nowhere else to go. Naor snorted. The Skilvendi, Proyas imagined, had little use for the maimed.
No, Zin, he said. I trust you as no other.
The barbarian scowled in sudden recognition. For an instant, Proyas glimpsed something untoward in his eyes, an incestuous fury, as though the man berated himself for overlooking a mortal danger.
He sent you,
Naor said.
He did.
Because of Confess.
Yes.
You're to remain with Confess and Jokthe while the holy war continues to Shima. For a long time the Skilvendi said nothing, though his look and pose spoke of howling rage. The barbarian even trembled. At last, with unnerving calm, he said,
I am to be his nursemaid.
Proyas breathed deep, frowned at the solicitations of several passers-by.
No,
he replied, lowering his voice.
And yes.
What do you mean?
You are to kill him.
The smell of blossoms in the dark.
Await him here,
the attendant said, then without another word withdrew the way they had both come. A hinge pealed as the doors ground shut. Iacchus peered across the grove, but the black beneath the trees confounded his eyes. Moonlight showered down in pale mockery of the sun, etching the flowering crowns. The blossoms were blue and black. He was not alone. From the absences pitting his perception, Iacchus knew that some 24 Koray bowmen had been positioned throughout the portico surrounding the grove. Even now they watched him, strings drawn. It was an understandable precaution, especially given recent events. Iacchus could scarce credit what he had seen and heard this day. He had entertained many apprehensions over the course of his journey from Shygek, the harrowing tales of what the Holy War, and by extension the Scarlet Spires had endured, had plagued him with premonitions of catastrophe. As the pilot had guided his ship into Jokthe's harbor 5 days before, he had braced himself for any number of disastrous revelations. But surely not this. The Holy War yoked to the whims of a living prophet? The consult made fact? The consult? And yet Iacchus had always been a meticulous man. Long before the canv had wrapped its cool and luxurious coils about his heart, things, he understood, possessed their own intrinsic order. It would take days for him to learn the extraordinary particulars of their new circumstance, and even longer for him to grasp the implications, He would not, as had Eleazarus apparently, despair before understanding. He would not break beneath their weight. Such a waste. Eli had been a great man, an inspired grandmaster. Once. The other rank principals would have to be consulted, and perhaps someone new elected. Someone rational. But first, he had to sound this so-called warrior prophet. This man with a 2,000-year-old name, Anassarimber. For the first time, Iacchus noticed the great stone dolmens rearing into moonlight from the obscurity of trees, and for a moment he pondered the long-dead people who had raised them. Such remnants, he thought, were the metric of ages, the pilings of the present. They spoke of a time when no Karaskand had encompassed these hills, a time when his own ancestors had ranged the endless plains beyond the great Kaiarsis. To lay eyes upon such monuments, he knew, to truly see them, was to understand the terrifying dimensions of what had been forgotten. Iacchus had always lamented the fact that for the Scarlet Spires, the past was little more than a resource, something to be looted of knowledge and authority. For his brothers, ruins were quarries, nothing more. In their eagerness to claim superiority over the Mandate, they had even gone so far as to make a virtue out of forgetfulness. The past cannot be bribed, they would say, and the future cannot be buried. This, he suspected, was about to change. The No-God. The Second Apocalypse. What if these things were real? Iacchus reeled at the thought. Images blighted his soul's eye. Corpses bobbing down the river Siut, Carathusel burning like some lurid scene from the sagas, dragons descending on their hallowed spires. First things first, he reminded himself. Alacrity in thought, patience in knowledge. A breeze descended on the grove. It wheezed through the trees, combing thousands of petals into the air. For a moment, they described the twists and eddies of various gusts, the way flotsam might reveal currents in water. Iacchus knew they should be beautiful. Then he sensed the mark, another sorcerer approaching through the dark lanes between the apple trees. Who? Iacchus resisted the urge to illuminate the courtyard, recalling the Koray trained upon him. Peering, he discerned a shadowy silhouette striding between black boughs, glimpsed the brow and left cheek of a bearded face in white moonlight. Yes, another rumor transformed into mad fact, that the Mandate schoolman now served as Prince Kellis's vizier, that he taught him the Gnosis. There was no end to the absurdities, it seemed.
Akamian,
he called out. How it must pain the man, he thought, having to treat with those who'd so wronged him. Iacchus had told Eleazarus that nothing good would come of abducting the man. So many miscalculations. It was a miracle their school yet possessed the strength it did. More shadow than man, Akamian paused some 15 paces away, gazed at Iacchus through hunched tree limbs. His voice was hard. If an eye offends thee, Iacchus. A bolt of terror struck the Canv addict. What was this? Eleazarus's drunken warning rang loud in his ears.
Beware the Mandate schoolman.
Where is Prince Kellis?
The silhouette remained motionless.
Indisposed. But I was told.
Iacchus trailed. His breath had grown cold and hard about his heart. Eleazarus knew, he realized.
He gave me to them. That was why he You were deceived. The Mandate schoolman said. What do you remember what you felt that night in Iothea?
You must have heard me coming for you. You must have heard the others screaming, calling for your help. There had been nightmares.
What is this?
The master of spies demanded.
What happens here?
He's given you to me, Iacchus. The warrior prophet. I asked for vengeance. I begged. Somehow, Akamian had muttered something between these words, and his eyes and mouth flared incandescent.
And he said yes.
Iacchus stiffened.
You begged?
The fire-coal eyes lowered in an unseen nod. Branches and blossoms were etched blood red against the greater black.
Yes.
Then, Iacus said, I shall not.
There were rules for overmatched sorcerers, rules that Iacus did not follow. There was no retreat from this place, not while his death lay pinched on bowstrings about him. He had been trapped. The same as a Kamian in the Seriotic Library. A turret of translucent stone leapt into existence about him, his reflexive wards. Then the air reverberated with his arcane mutter song, a guttural counterpoint to the more keening cadences of a Kamian. To either side of the Mandate Schoolman, two thunderheads unfolded from nothingness, each black-hearted, each tilted to the axis of the man's position, the Hulari twin tempests. A flare of lightning, gossamer threads of incandescence danced in spasms about Akamian's spherical wards. Shadows swung like maces about the feet of the surrounding colonnades. Momentary light gleamed across the koray poised within the portico. Carved white as salt behind his abstract defenses, Akamian continued chanting. Iacus sang faster, yoked his desperation to the tortured meanings that tumbled from soul into voice. Passion became semantics, and semantics became real. Lightning forked and flashed, its fury redoubled, until Akamian looked a ghost suspended in a half-buried sun. Limbs snapped. Blossoms exploded skyward, wheeled like burning moths against the firmament. The surrounding trees erupted in flame, became shining pillars of fire. The dolmens loomed orange from the black. Akamian stepped forward, past the blasted trees. Horrified, Iacus realized that Akamian toyed with him. The Canv addict abandoned the Hulari, seized on the great maul of his school. The dragon head. A scaled neck reared into existence above him. The unseen maw dipped, vomited a cataract of golden fire. Crying out his song, Iacus watched the deluge part about the man's wards. Ropes of fire glided down and away, as though burning oil had been cast across a sphere of glass. But there were cracks, fractures that bled sheets of faint vertical light. Again the dragon head struck, illuminating the entirety of the grove, blowing petals skyward in locust clouds. And still, the Mandate Schoolman advanced, stepping through coiling wreaths of flame, singing that mad, incomprehensible song. The fractures had multiplied, deepened. Iacus screamed the words, but there was a flash of something brighter than lightning, the pure dispensation of force, unmuted by image or interpretation. Geometries scythed through the air, parabolas of blinding white swinging from perfect lines, all converging upon his ward. Ghost stone shivered and cracked, fell away like shale beneath a hammer. An explosion of brilliance, then. Heedless of the dark, the chieftain of the Utamat rode from the Gate of Horns and into the surrounding Anathpanean hills. He hobbled his horse, a Umarnan black apportioned to him following the destruction of Padiraja's host, then struck a fire atop a high promontory overlooking the city. The hollow in his belly had crept into his chest, where it congealed, clawing, like the crow his mad grandmother always said lived within her breast. He lay a while, his broad back against a still warm boulder, his arms out and swaying, his fingertips teased by trembling grasses. He savored the warmth and breathed. Gradually the crow ceased thrashing, and he thought,
so many stars.
He was no longer of the people. He was more. There was no thought he could not think, no act he could not undertake, no lips he could not kiss. Nothing was forbidden. Staring into the infinite fields of black, he drifted asleep. He dreamed that he was bound to Serwe upon the circumfix, pressed hard against her, within her, and it seemed no coupling could be more profound. You're mad, she whispered, her breath moist with urgency.
I am yours,
he gasped in an outland tongue.
You are the only Trek remaining.
A corpse's gaping grin.
But I'm dead.
These words struck like stone, and he awoke, curled half-naked across gravel and grasses. He scrambled, bleary and numb, to his feet. He drunkenly brushed grit and chaff from his skin. What dreams were these? What kind of man? Then he saw her, standing above his fire, wearing a simple linen shift, her skin orange and lithe and flawless, like an Enrithi goddess conjured from the flames. Her eyes shone with miniature conflagrations, sheets of hair twined about her chin and cheeks, as blonde as slaves. Serwe. Nayor shook his head and mane, clawed his cheeks. He opened his mouth, but breath would not come. The wind seemed glacial. Serwe. She smiled, then leapt into the blackness that framed her. Snarling, he sprinted after her, fully expecting to find nothing. Pausing where she had stood, he kicked through the grasses as though searching for a lost coin or weapon. The sight of her footprint knocked him to his knees.
Serwe!
He cried, peering across the dark. He stumbled to his feet.
Serwe!
Then he saw her again, leaping from rock to rock down the shadowy slope, silver in moonlight. Suddenly all the world seemed steep, a concatenation of cliff faces. He glimpsed her silhouette slip between the fists of two great boulders. Karaskand sprawled across the distances below her, a labyrinth of turquoise and black. He lurched forward, began racing down the darkling slopes, leaping into the void. He crashed into a stand of dwarf yuccas, tripped through a grotesquerie of limbs. A brace of thrushes exploded into the black sky, screeching. He rolled to his feet, then ran, seemingly without breath or heartbeat, his feet magically finding their sandaled way across the murky ground.
Serwe!
He paused between the boulders, scanned the moonlit terrain. There, her willowy figure, racing like a hare across the footings of the hill. Spring grasses whisking across bare shins, great loping strides like a wolf across a killing field. Then he was skidding across gravel, flying over sudden plummets. Leaning low, he threw himself at her distant figure, his many scarred arms scything to and fro at his side, chest heaving, spittle trailing across his chin and cheeks. The night roared, but he could not close the interval. She sprinted across fallow earth, disappeared over the lip of a terraced meadow.
You're mine!
He howled. Before him, Karaskand grew until it riddled the whole horizon with snaking streets and innumerable rooftops. The forward bastions of the Triamic walls loomed larger, swallowing the city's nearer quarters. Soon only the heights and their monumental structures were visible. He glimpsed her shape again, just before she vanished into the blackness, harbored by a grove of olive trees. He dashed after her through the rush of stationary limbs. When he broke the grove's far side, he found himself on the battlefield, near the remains of a burned-out byre. She was little more than a thread of white, climbing the roll of dead fields, heading toward the great heaps where the Fainim dead had been thrown. For a moment, part of him despaired. His head swam, his limbs burned with the strain of his exertions. His wind had abandoned him, yet his legs still pounded across the rutted earth. The moon cast his shadow before him, and with reckless limbs he raced it, leaping dead horses, bruising mats of spring clover. He lost sight of her among the dead, but somehow he knew she would wait. It seemed he no longer breathed, but he could smell the dead as he willed himself up the last fallow slope. The stench soon became overpowering, a sourness so raw, so earthen deep, it clawed convulsions from his stomach. It possessed a flavor that could be tasted only on the bottom of the tongue. So holy. He stumbled to his knees and retched, then found himself staggering across a landscape of corpses. In some places they merely matted the ground, a macrame of stripped limbs, but elsewhere they'd been heaped dozens, even hundreds deep, into mounds that seeped something like bone oil from their base. Moonlight fell plain across naked skin, gleamed across exposed teeth, probed the hollows of innumerable gaping mouths. He found her standing alone in a clearing, rutted by the wains that had been used to gather the dead. Her back was turned to him. He approached warily, wondering at her nightmarish beauty. Beyond her, above a black screen of trees, a signal fire glittered atop one of Karaskan's towers.
"Set away," he gasped.
She whirled and her face flew apart, as though snakes had been braided about her skull. He charged into her, bore her down, and for an instant he was inside her impossible expression, saw gums reaching, pink and moist, to wild, lidless eyes. They rolled among the dead until he threw himself free with an inarticulate roar. He staggered backward. There was no time for horror. She twirled in the air and something exploded across his jaw. He sailed headfirst into the corpses. He clutched a cold hand in the scramble to regain his feet. He tripped on a bloated torso, reached back, braced himself against the mud of dead faces. The skin spy regarded him, reassembled its features into those of another. As Nayor watched, the blonde hair fell from its pate in a feathery cascade, drawn away by the breeze, and for some reason, this seemed the most horrific of all. He stood, slicked by sweat, gasping for breath. He was unarmed, and though part of him had shouted this from the beginning, it seemed he realized it only now.
"I'm dead."
But the thing turned to the sky instead of attacking, drawn by the sound of beating wings. Nayor followed its gaze, saw a raven descending in the dark. To the right of the skin spy, one corpse lay askew a heap of others, its elbows bent out backward, its face turned toward Nayor, eyes drooling from sunken sockets, lips drawn back from black leather gums. The bird landed on its gray cheek. It regarded him with a white, human face, no larger than an apple. Nayor cursed, stumbled backward. What new outrage was this?
"Old,"
the tiny face said in a reedy voice.
"Old is the covenant between our peoples."
Nayor stared in horror.
"I belong to no people,"
he said blankly. A vertiginous silence. It peered at him with an avian canniness, as though forced to revisit certain long-standing assumptions.
"Perhaps,"
it said.
"But something binds you to him. You would not have saved him otherwise. You would not have killed my child."
Nayor spat.
"Nothing binds me."
It craned its tiny face to the side, bird curious.
"But the past binds us all, Skilvendi, as the bow binds the flight of an arrow. All of us have been knocked, raised, and released. All that remains is to see where we land. To see whether we strike true."
He couldn't breathe. It seemed agony simply to look, as though everything chattered with a million masticating teeth, everything real. Why could nothing be simple? Why could nothing be pure? Why must the world continually heap indignities upon him and obscenities about how much must he endure?
"I know whom you hunt."
"Lies!"
Nayor raved.
"Lies upon lies!"
"He came to you, didn't he? The father of the warrior prophet."
Diminutive amusement flickered across the creature's face.
"The Dunyane."
The chieftain of the Utumot gazed at the thing, his thoughts battered senseless by a chorus of conflicting passions, confusion, outrage, hope. Then, at last, he recalled the only track remaining, the only true track, though his heart had known it all along, the one certainty, hate. He grew very calm.
"The hunt is over," he said. "Tomorrow, the holy war marches for Zarash and Amotu. I am to remain behind."
"You have been moved, nothing more. In Benjuka, every move bespeaks a new rule."
The small face regarded him, its bald scalp shining beneath the white moon.
"We are that new rule, Skilvendi."
Eyes tiny and impossibly old, an intimation of power rumbling through vein, heart, and bone.
"Not even the dead escape the plate."
When Akamian found Zynemus in his rooms, the marshal was as drunk as he had ever seen him. Zynemus coughed, a sound like gravel crashing across the planked box of a wain.
Did you do it?
Yes.
Good, good. Were you injured? Did he hurt you in any way?
No.
Do you have them?
Akamian paused, unsettled that Zynemus hadn't said good in response to his second answer as well. Does he want me to suffer?
Do you have them?
Zynemus exclaimed. Yes.
Good. Good,
Zynemus said. He bolted from his chair, but with the same rigid aimlessness with which he seemed to do everything now that he had no eyes.
Give them to me.
He had shouted this as though Akamian were a knight of Atrempus. Akamian swallowed. I don't understand.
Leave them! Leave me!
Zin, you must help me understand.
Leave!
Akamian started, such was the intensity of his cry. All right, he muttered, moving for the door. His stomach heaved and hitched as though the floor pitched a sea. All right. He yanked the door wide, but for some perverse reason, simply stood still for a heartbeat, then slammed it shut as though leaving in fury. He stood breathless, watching his friend turn and stride toward the westward wall, his left hand pawing the air before him, his right clutching tight the blood-stained cloth.
Finally,
Zynemus muttered under his breath, either sobbing or laughing.
Finally.
He stamped palm and fingers across the wall, moving to his left. He left a trail of blood prints across the cerulean panels, then the Nilnameshi pastoral. When he reached the mirror, he stopped, his finger fluttering across the ivory frame as he positioned himself squarely before it. He became very still, so much so that Akamian feared he would hear the breath that rasped so loudly in his own ears. For a time, it seemed Zynemus gazed into the phlegmatic pits where his eyes had once laughed and fumed. There was an air of longing to his blind scrutiny. With horror, Akamian watched him fumble with a cloth, then bring one hand to each of his sockets. When he drew away his hands, Iacus's weeping eyes stared askew from phalanges of angry skin. Walls and ceiling lurched.
Open!
The marshal of Atrempus wailed. He jerked his dead and bloody gaze about the room, pausing for a heart-stopping moment on Akamian.
Open!
Then he began thrashing through his apartments. Akamian slipped through the door and fled. In the dark, Eleazarus clutched his friend, rocked him back and forth, knowing that he held a far greater dark in his arms.
Shh, shh. Ellie,
his master of spies gasped. The man shook and blubbered, yet somehow seemed wan, even in his anguish.
Ellie!
Shh, Iacus. Do you remember what it is to see?
A shudder passed through the addict's form. Ed rolled in a drunken nod. Blood spilled from the linen dressings, traced dark lines across his transparent cheek.
The words!
Eleazarus hissed.
Do you remember the words?
In sorcery, everything depended on the purity of meaning. Who knew what blinding might do?
Yes.
Then you are whole.